One of the things we forget is people with pre-existing mental health problems have such a toolkit of things that they've learned over their years. I always say you must know a lot by now. You probably could teach a course. And then they start telling me all the things that they know that they've learned from therapy, they've learned from podcasts, they've learned from reading. And even though, of course, they're having a really hard time right now, they forgot all the things that they know and they start talking about what they forgot that they're already doing. And then they start remembering what they might want to continue to do.
That is Simply Focus with Avery Cherney and Dominic Gouda for Live and Joy and Deep.
Are you ready for this new episode? Then please welcome your hosts, Elfie Cherney and Dominic Godad.
Hello and welcome back to episode number 101. We are here with Beverly Court on Zoom today. Hi, Beverly.
Hi, Elfie. Hi, Dominic.
Hi, Beverly. It's so good to see you. We met each other for the first time at Taos at the SFU conference that was organized by Elliot Conney and Adam Fröhrer. You were on our podcast there already, which is really exciting to have you back. We met each other again in Montreal at last year's SFPTA conference. We had the honor to have some lovely conversations with you in our room for confidence, where you shared some really beautiful stories about how you are taking care of yourself in the current situation and also the differences you make for others by volunteering and also with your work as a psychologist in private practice, as a therapist, as a person who loves to spread the word about postmodern approaches, about solution focus, about teaching solution focus and making a difference in the world. So thank you very much for being here with us today, Beverly.
So to start with, what fascinates you with solution focus?
Well, I knew you were going to ask that question. So it got me thinking, since you invited me to do this interview, about how I ended up being, more generally speaking, solution focused as a therapist over the last, I've been a therapist since the 1970s. So it's a long, long winding road. And when I first got into therapy, it was all about human potential and altered states of consciousness and being the best human that you could be. And my degree's in humanistic psychology, and it was like way out there. My first job was in an alcohol and drug treatment center as a behavioral therapist. So it was a really the opposite experience. But as I got more comfortable, somehow Vancouver became a hub for narrative therapy. And we had conferences here in the 90s. So I think Insu Kimberg and Steve DeShazer had started in the 80s. And I think the Milwaukee practice had started by then. And Insu had been invited to the narrative therapy conference. So there's this really kind of big family of narrative and solution-focused therapists celebrating as a way of practicing a type of therapy that was social justice, that was social construction, that was kind of challenging the dominant discourse. It was very fit in well with my feminist ideas. And I realized over the time that my real desire is to be a therapist who doesn't do harm, because a lot of therapy has harmed a lot of people. It really has. And there's even recently two young therapists who have a very bad therapy podcast that gives voice to people who have had. And of course, there's always people doing not well in their field, but in the name of therapy, there's been a lot of awful things that have been done in this world and ways of treating people. And if I wanted to be a therapist who at least can be useful and does the least harm possible, and through narrative therapy and solution-focused therapy, I felt I could do the most use and the least harm. And that fit well for me. And I also was really influenced by Scott Miller way back, and I started doing my own little transparency questions, like what stood out for you? What were your sparkling moments? What was most useful? And I would ask my clients that, and then I would ask myself that, and then we would compare and see that what they thought was really fabulous was not what I thought was really fabulous. And that was so humbling and useful. And I would pull that out every once in a while. And then the ORS and the SRS came out. And so it's always been really important to me in my practice to have feedback from my clients and not to fool myself about whether I'm doing a good job, and hope that in keeping the communication open with my clients, that they're coming because they want to, not because they think that's what you're supposed to do when you're a patient or a client, and that they always are free to give me feedback and make the therapy work better. So it's kind of a long answer to your question. Did I answer your question?
Yes. And it seems that you're constantly learning from your clients, learning to integrate new elements and really, yeah, developing your practice.
I'm glad that you mentioned that, because a major value for me is I am always learning new things, reading a ton, always, you know, wanting to know more. I'm extremely curious. I think when I was younger, I just thought I wanted to go into psychology because I was just curious about what people did the way they did. And I grew up in a home that was very intellectually curious. My father was very much seeking meaning and wanting to know post-Holocaust about evil. And so he, I don't know if you know much about California, Vancouver, the human potential movement came all the way up from California to Vancouver. It was this big hub of the Baba Ram Dass, Alan Watts, all of that whole world back then. So it was always steeped in what's happening, what's next, what are people thinking, how can you expand yourself, what's out there, you know. So I'm still a real novelty seeker in that way. And at some point, I started to want to hone my skills more in solution focus. And I used to read a lot of from Harry Korman and Pradika Banik. And also, there's a psychologist in Toronto named Ronald Warner. And I went and took his course because I wanted to start teaching medical doctors more, because my daughter is a doctor and my son-in-law is a nurse. And I thought this is really useful for them to be able to learn to use this language. So I started to improve my ability and my skills and my ability to talk more about the practice by taking and reading more so I could be a better teacher. So that got me started again. And then somehow I found Elliot and the Brief International. I think I took the second one. And that just like, wow, I've never gone to an SBTA or any conferences on solution focus. So this was the first time I actually connected up with a group of people doing what I was doing and even identified myself with a type of therapy. That was a big step for me in my late years to identify like that. But it was a great group of people. And then we went to Portugal for a bike trip. And I decided while I was there that there was a weekend at Brief. And I took a weekend with Chris and stayed with him. And that was like really fun, really fun. He walks really fast and he does not wait for you. So it was very busy. It was very following him through the subways and to his office. So that was really great. And that was very inspiring. And you know, now I've gone to Elliot's conferences and I stay connected to people. And I met you guys and I'd only heard your podcast a little bit before then. And then I saw you there. You were like celebrities for me, honestly, solution focused celebrities, because I didn't even know there was this whole world of Europeans as much as I do now.
Isn't it nice how we all connect through these different conferences and through different means with a podcast and now online in different groups and really, yeah, can't connect the whole world. And you also came to the SFBTA conference.
I did.
In Montreal. That was
like, yes, I came. I decided it's in Canada and I'll go visit my daughter in Toronto. And I decided I'm just going to go for it and go. And I'm really glad I did, actually.
We were glad to see you there and also to hear lately from you in the Room for Confidence about elements that you are taking from people all over the world to develop your practice, to learn, to try out, especially in the situation right now, mm-hmm. also to be most useful for your clients. And one thing that you've been doing lately is working on a telephone. And
yes.
It was also interesting to hear what you do and how you do that.
So there's two parts to that, because the psychologists of BC organized themselves very quickly because we have some very active crisis responding psychologists here who are quite prominent in the field. So there is already a program called PFA, which is psychological first aid. And when you go into a crisis like Hurricane Katrina or into refugee camps and you provide, it's like first aid, it's like a first aid tent, but for psychological issues. So your purpose is to really connect people up with resources and to help them with some basic coping skills, whether it's for breathing or maybe there's some cognitive things you can help them with to be reassuring, to reassure them that whatever they're feeling is normal and to just settle their minds, because everyone thinks that they should be coping better, especially during this time, which is the only time I've ever done this. Everyone feels they should be coping better and everyone feels that they have it good and better than this person, and why are they complaining? Because these people have it worse. I already have a house, I have a job, I'm still working, why am I so upset? So part of our job is just to normalize, normalize, and normalize, and then connect people up with resources. So PFA is something that actually they have an app for it. The American military have a wonderful app, it's so useful. And it's used all over the world, and it's very easy to train, and you can get people moving very quickly to provide this. So I've been a little bit subversive, as I tend to be in doing this. And because I've been so connected now with all the Europeans, and I'm attending as many of the conferences as I can that aren't at 5 a.m. for us. In fact, I did take one that was at 5, but that's my limit. So I went to the SF Collective, but I did see this course, my solution focused possibilities in England. And so they were offering a course in using solution focus for texting and email. And I thought, interesting. Maybe I'll do that because I'm doing these phone calls and I'm just wondering, would there be some kind of transfer of information that I might be able to use? So I did get up at 5 a.m. to take that. And I'm really glad I did because they're experimenting with what they're calling the condensed version. And I thought, wow, this is a really kind of concise way. Like I'm still doing the right way of the PFA, but I'm asking my solution focused questions. And I'm finding it very inspiring what people come up with and using a variation on the condensed version and finding it's giving me a framework instead of kind of like picking and choosing. I just decided I'll just do one thing. Now, again, I have no idea how helpful or useful it is afterwards. We can't do anything. We just have our half hour, 20 minutes to half an hour. And this is for anyone in BC who needs help. They can sign up and then we call them back.
And it's single sessions you do?
Single sessions, half an hour. They can have one a day if they want, whatever they need. We started off just doing it for health professionals and essential workers, and we're just getting a trickle. And, you know, psychologists aren't good marketers. They don't really know how to market. And so we weren't really getting, wondering why aren't we getting people. And finally, we got on the news and we opened it up to the population and 500 calls in like 2 days. So everybody is calling. I mean, and it slowed down a little bit because BC is opening up and we've done really well. But what we ended up with is mainly people with pre-existing mental health problems. Because we're after our calls, we have a list and we do mild, medium, and severe. There's very few people in the mild, whereas the first set of calls were all mild. Now they're medium and severe. And we do have a service where people can get online hour-long counseling. We can refer people who are severe to that. So I've been talking to Greg quite a bit, Greg Overbeck from SF Possibilities, and I emailed him. I said, I thought I'd just let you know that I'm using your condensed version and it's not really helpful for research because I can't follow up, but I'm telling you that it's making my calls very inspiring. And when I go on the debriefing, I hear how exhausting it is for the other psychologists who are more psychodynamic, really, and feeling they're not doing enough and they are feeling a lot of angst. And I'm feeling I'm having these really good conversations with people who are getting in touch with what they're doing well and what they forgot that they could do well. And one of the things we forget is people with pre-existing mental health problems have such a toolkit of things that they've learned over their years. And all I do is ask them what they I always say, you must know a lot by now. You probably could teach a course. And then they start telling me all the things that they know that they've learned from therapy, they've learned from podcasts, they've learned from reading. And even though, of course, they're having a really hard time right now, they forgot all the things that they know. And they start talking about what they forgot that they're already doing. And then they start remembering what they might want to continue to do. So you kind of know that you're being somewhat useful when someone says, I didn't think of it that way. And so then it's like, okay, I think that's a good thing. And now they're thinking of it differently because that's kind of the goal. You want people to think about something differently in a good way.
So what other questions are you asking?
Let me just tell you specifically, it might be just a good idea to not misrepresent the condensed version because I use that term. So I wrote it down, of course, so that I would have it because that's what I do. I made my own little version here. So the condensed version, it starts with a scale instead of best hopes. And I don't really use a scale because that's a little bit jarring in a phone call when people are calling. And so first of all, they have to kind of talk about why they called and I ask them how I could be useful. So I don't ask them sort of best hopes either. I don't use those words. I just say, you know, how can we know this is going to be useful for you? You know, when you hang up with me, you know, what's going to happen here maybe, or what do you want to have happen here to be useful? And everyone usually says, I just want to feel less anxious. I just want to feel better. You know, very, very simple things because I really want them to know this is just about now and we're not dealing with the long-term health problems. We have to make that very clear. So then the question that I usually ask is, you know, what have you already been doing? And that they've got it, best hopes, resources, preferred future. What have you been doing already? How have you managed to do those things? If you're able to make further improvements, what would that look like? And who would notice those changes and how would they react? That's how they've condensed it. So that's kind of my framework. And I don't always get all around to that, but I try and ask at least one interactional question, you know, from their life that they would notice. So they've got that external perspective. And every conversation, except maybe one that was a very difficult one. Besides that, I feel like I've left people, when people hang up, they're smiling, they're laughing. This is by phone, and they're laughing and they're feeling a bit lighter. So I like the calls.
And that within 20 minutes, within half an hour.
Yeah. And I feel that vicarious resilience, right? Just like Jackie says.
Vicarious resilience. I love this term. Maybe you could briefly explain what that is.
Well, I learned it from Jackie Van Sifferberg. And I heard her speak of it. You know, I can't remember whether it was part of the Brief International when she talked about it or whether when I heard her, I don't remember, but it's in the last few years. And she talked about the fact that everyone she sees has experienced some kind of trauma. And she, over time, recognized that between her and her client, what you want to experience at the end of the session is not vicarious trauma, but vicarious resilience, because the person you've been talking to starts to tell you about all the things that they have done in order to cope with whatever it is they've been doing. And they start to recognize their resources and their choices and their options that they actually exercised, because you have such a shrunken view. So vicarious resilience, I thought, is brilliant. And I know she had some controversy when she first introduced it. Like, it's not the therapist's job to feel good after a session, but actually it's a joint feeling good, I think.
Yeah. And so when I heard about vicarious resilience for the first time, I was really inspired, because it was this really turnaround from a long history of research about vicarious trauma to look at it from a different angle and look at it also from a research perspective. Okay, if there is trauma, there might also be resilience when we talk with our clients. And I think this is really inspiring. And it also brings in this perspective of mutual influence. And I think this is one of the things you highlighted for me also in your story about what fascinates you about solution focus, this importance of doing no harm and being useful for people, and in carefully looking at the process that you co-create with the people you work with. Mm-hmm. And I really like how you shared that you did your own session rating scales, and then also like really using all different kind of resources in order to find out what supports you in being as useful as possible for your clients. And I know you're working together with Adam Fröhrer on a project as well, which also points in this direction. So could you tell us a little bit about the research you're doing there?
We've worked on a paper that we presented at Elliott's SFU conference in Austin just before everything shut down. We were hearing about it and going, oh my God, but we did go. And it's called Creating a Common Language, How Solution-Focused Brief Therapy Reflects Current Principles of Change and Common Factors. So this is Adam and I, and also Cecil Walker, who was a student of Adam's and lives in Atlanta as well. So like I was pursuing them a bit to be part of research. And then Adam and Elliot asked me, would you like to be on a research committee? And I went, yes, because it's very hard to do research when you're in private practice. I mean, and this is a literature review. It's not really research. It's not researching outcomes or anything. So we ended up in this committee that took various forms. And I was visiting my daughter in Hanover, Ontario in the winter, a year and a half ago when her son was born. And it was 30 degrees below. I had nothing to do. I was just stuck there. And so I did the like grunt work of this because I had nothing to do. So I took all these papers on common factors and principles of change, and I like scotch tape paper together and made this big, huge grid and went what everybody was saying and what they had in common. It was just like massive. I mean, it was really physically massive. It was crazy, but I had no distractions, so it was possible. So we started with that. We picked a bunch of different researchers, the ones that were really presenting themselves and other people, because there's so much overlap. So my motivation is listen to solution-focused practitioners. And in Elliot's SFU, there's lots of newcomers. You know, it isn't people who have been doing it for a long time, but it's lots of newcomers, and they don't seem to be able to talk about it. When they work, go back to their agencies, like it's something unexplainable. And that was like, why? How is this unexplainable to me? That's my feeling. Like, it isn't unexplainable. I mean, we should be able to talk about what we're doing because it's just another way of doing what everyone else is doing, but we're doing it in our little special ingredient way, and you're doing it in your way. But underlying, if we're all doing it well, we're kind of doing the same thing. Some people do it better than others, and some approaches do it better than others. So my motivation was, let's create a common language, because I've so been influenced by Scott Miller and all of the stuff that he does, and thinking this is the underlying reason and we should be talking like this. And then as a psychologist, I got a paper from Marvin Goldfried called Obtaining Consensus in Psychotherapy, What Holds Us Back? And it was an overview of the field and how behind we are, because you can't get anyone to agree on anything. And everybody wants to say that their way of doing things is better. And nobody refers back to history to say we've actually been doing the same thing. Now I'm calling it this, you're calling it this, but it's always been there since the 1940s. Why are you pretending it's new? Don't make up new stuff. Base it in the history of what works, because it changes so quickly. There are some things that actually we can agree on. So why don't we just agree and move forward? So he really feels like research and everything about the field is really kind of backwards, and that they're not listening enough to clinicians to find out what they actually do in the office. So that the clinicians, this has always been an old thing, clinicians and researchers don't communicate well. And he wants to improve that, but he also wants to say, these are the principles of change. This is what we all do. Why don't we just all talk about what we do and how you implement it is your business, but just do it well so it meets these criteria. Simple, right? That's what our paper is about.
So you brought together all these different voices.
Yes, in this lovely chart. And then we made another chart that says, these are the questions that you might want to ask yourself as a therapist to see if you're meeting the criteria in these 7 common factors and principles of change. So the factors we chose were, first of all, we gave the ideology and rationale for these 4 because they were the most recent and also robust about what's going on today. Then there's one that's expectation, hope, resource activation. Then there's the therapeutic alliance, which of course is the most researched. Then there's the tasks of therapy, and where all of these have quite a bit in common about the tasks of therapy. And then there's use of client factors, the therapist effect and self-regulation, and monitoring and process outcome. So those are the 7 categories. And then we have questions under each category that a therapist should ask themselves. How do you draw on the strengths and resources to help your client achieve their goals? In what ways do you expand on the spontaneous changes that the client experiences outside therapy? So there's a whole series of questions that come underneath each of these categories. And I also took them to other therapists who aren't solution focused to see whether it related to them, because I didn't want to have jargon. And I said, would you answer these questions? Are these things you think about? And you know what? A lot of them don't think about these things. Mm. That was really interesting. And it was like, wow, no, I hadn't thought about this. Mm. So that in and of itself is kind of interesting. And then, and this part is more of Adam's part. I did this background part. And then we said, okay, using the briefer manual, what does solution focus do that meets this criteria? What do we do? Where are we doing this? What is what we do? How does it fit? And then the research and how it increases the evidence base. And that's Adam's piece.
And what did you find out there?
We do a good job. Solution-focused therapy does a good job at really meeting these criteria. And it's not unexplainable. It's really explainable. And the language is transferable. And interestingly enough, and I don't know whether this is worth mentioning, but I'm just going to say, I just read the EBTA's 2020 paper. I want to try and see if we can integrate it, because they describe the philosophy of solution-focused therapy from a philosophy of language that I find very elegant, and I love reading it, but it's not that translatable to what we're doing to talk about it in an office, in a therapy room. It makes sense to me, and I understand it, but I feel like this is a bridge, because even in their paper, they say, this is what solution-focused therapists are trying to do, and it's exactly what common factors and principles of change say. There's 6 points, matches this perfectly. And so all we're doing here is giving a different kind of language. It's not a philosophy of language, and it's not a theory of process. It's, you know, principles of change. which is stepping on those very sensitive theory toes, because I know they talk about that, there shouldn't be a theory, but I feel this doesn't get in the way, just like I don't think theirs gets in the way. So this is just something I discovered a few days ago, actually, from the SF Collective. And then I told Adam, and then Adam told me about this paper, then I got the paper, and then I added it to our paper.
It sounds exciting.
Yeah, I'm excited. You can tell, I could talk about it forever and bore other people, so.
And when and where will we be able to read more about it?
Well, we hope to get it published in the next publication of the JSFP journal, the one that's coming out in July. Maybe, I'm not sure when the next one, but we want to get it in to get into the next one.
Oh, that's great. So we'll keep you posted, and you'll also find the link to the journal in the resource section of this podcast.
Beverly, looking back at your journey as a psychologist and as a therapist and as someone applying the principles of postmodern ideas, if there is one thing we have not yet talked about that was really crucial in your learning process that might also inspire other people, what could that be?
Well, maybe it's my constant desire to level the playing field. And just thinking about that as I've been talking to you and kind of reflecting on what I've done. And that seems to have been a very important piece for me. And as I mentioned earlier to you about the reflecting team, which levels the playing field between people within a different hierarchy. And I went on a board for the first time, the Jewish Family Service Agency of Vancouver. I was invited on as the mental health person to help kind of bridge the gap between board members and staff, because they were noticing, as like on many boards, there's a big gap sometimes between when it's not a user board, between who you get on a board and what actually people do. Like mainly dancers are not on dancer boards. And so there's sometimes a kind of a communication gap and a misunderstandings. And so when I got on the board in 96, I was on the board from 96 to 2006, and I was president at the end. So we went from actually using the phone to email. I remember my son was 4, because my first email password was Jared, my son's name, S, 4. So I remember we got the computer when he was 4, and it was in 1995. So there was a big change in how we managed ourselves, but there was this big gap. And so one of the things that I decided to do is use the reflecting team, which is something that I had really loved from narrative therapy. It's called Outsider Witness. And there's so many amazing experiments, and it was really influenced by anthropology. My sister-in-law and brother-in-law are anthropologists. We have tons of conversations about anthropology and solution-focused, and they're actually doing solution-focused more because of me and their anthropology research. So I read anthropology, I read some of the sources, and the Outsider Witness is so honoring of people who don't get heard. And it's such a cool way of having people of very different ways of thinking find some kind of way of relating to each other. So in the reflecting team, I took board members and staff, and I would interview the staff members and the small group of board members, and there was a structure. So I would interview people kind of like an appreciative inquiry, you know, what brought you to this job, what you do best, what are you most proud of, what are your challenges, what are you hoping people, if they hear anything that you say today, what is it that what you want to stand out to them, like ask them lots of questions that builds who they are and what they do. And the board is required to think about and wonder in that kind of subjunctive way, what am I hearing that really stands out for me? And what is it about me that makes that stand out? So they're not allowed to say anything about a question straight to the person unless they put it in the context of why that particular thing of interest to them. So instead of having that one-way questioning, you get to find out something about me, about why I'm asking you that question. You have that kind of shared experience. So that was my goal, because I know that a reflecting team can create that. And it's challenging, because people sometimes, it's hard for them to get on board with that. So a person may say, you went to work for a Jewish agency, and I've never worked for a Jewish agency. Is there something about it that makes you really glad that you did that? Or, you know, I've never been in a social service, and I have all of these ideas. Could you just tell me what keeps you going? You know, so they would have to say something, not a story about themselves, but just a reason why. So then, you know, they do their thing. And then the persons I interviewed them about what stood out for them. and then we have an open conversation. So when the board speaks among themselves, they don't talk to the person who I interviewed. They're just talking amongst themselves and wondering about these things. So people loved it. I mean, the staff loved it because they got to be heard. And when you hear the impact of your words on another person for the first time, it's pretty amazing. And I also did it with Holocaust survivors, actually, I just remembered, because they usually give a talk to a group and then people ask them questions. And then the people who have the most deepest questions wait till afterwards to ask them, and they go up afterwards. And instead, I did a reflecting team where I interviewed the speaker, and then we did a reflecting team as the listeners, and they talked amongst themselves about what they wondered about and what stood out for them. So the Holocaust survivor could hear people expressing themselves to each other in a way that they'd never heard before. And they got to listen. And when you listen, then you listen differently than when you're talked at. And this ability for the Holocaust survivor, for the staff to be able to listen in instead of being talked at, is a very honoring experience.
Beautiful. I wonder, like, I can sense the difference it can make for the people in the room, well, with a Holocaust survivor and, you know, having this different kind of conversation actually with each other. And then when it comes to staff members and the board of an organization, I wonder what differences did that make later?
Well, for one thing, the staff really felt that they got a sense of who's on the board besides just the little like bios. And they felt that they really were heard and that people were really interested in what they did, because they always felt that they're not really that interested. They're on the board because they want to do good. And this is a bunch of social workers and they do social work stuff and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But they found this: when you hear people touched by your words, you then have a different experience of them as a co-human. And board members had never really had a chance to hear people who do that kind of work. They're just very distant from it. And so they were very inspired by the passion and the just commitment of people who do go into social services, because it's not where you make a lot of money. But they just heard the kind of inspiration they get from working with people in a very different way than they have experience with.
And we are very inspired by your words and about your experiences, and are very touched by the stories and also your learning process over those years as a psychologist and with solution focus, and also always constantly learning and wanting to find out new things and develop your practice. And we're very, very curious about the challenge of the week.
I know you always ask that. And I was thinking about a favorite question that I find my clients really connect with, which comes from that idea that we always have a good reason for why we do things. And I find a lot of people talk about, oh, I self-sabotage. They might use that kind of language. Or I never say anything good about myself. I never can enjoy my successes. And when you say to a person, I'm sure you have a really good reason why you do that, and it may not be giving you the result, but you must be hoping for a result that's going to make it better for you. So let's talk about what you might be hoping that will give you, or what you might be hoping it will prevent, or what you might be thinking that this is useful for. And so then when people finally get to, it motivates me if I never say anything good about myself, because then I'll keep going. Or I remember this last woman, she said, I don't want to lose my edge. And so she spent her time preventing losing her edge. But when she got that, and then you can start asking, so what would you rather do instead? If you don't want to worry about losing your edge, what would you rather do instead? She said, I'd like to encourage myself to keep my edge. And so my challenge would be that we need to be really generous and kind with ourselves when we hear ourselves saying, I don't know why I do that. That's stupid. That's this, that's that. And say to yourself, I'm smart. I'm doing it for a good reason. I'm not getting as much as I want out of it. So what is my good reason? And then look at what your good reason is, accept it, and say, what would I rather do instead?
Thank you very much.
I'm looking forward to doing the challenge and to finding out my good reasons for, and I already have something in mind. So thank you very much for the challenge, Beverly, and also thank you very much for the conversation.
So now I'm, of course, very curious what you will find out, Elfie, and I'm very curious what you out there will find out with this question, and also what inspired you in our conversation we had today with Beverly.
So please go and comment in the comment field of our podcast on www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast, and then go to episode number 101. and you know what inspires you, what is important for you, what is a learning for you might also inspire someone else to go their journey, inspire someone else to try out something new, to explore something new, to stay curious about what they do. So please go and come and share with us and let us know and help spreading the word about what works and how we can learn even more about what works.
And as we mentioned in the podcast, we're all connected. There's so many good things going on worldwide, online and offline. There are so many conferences, so many great people out there doing solution focus, connecting with each other and learning from each other. So yeah, let's grow together as a solution focused community.
And of course, you will find Beverly's website and all the resources we mentioned in the podcast in our resource section of the podcast. Go to www.sfontour.com, Simply Focus Podcast, and then to this episode.
So thank you very much, Beverly, for inspiring us today, for joining all those great events worldwide, for making a difference there, for coming to our room for confidence and inspiring us with your stories, really being in touch with each other and yeah, being on this journey together.
And I also want to thank you for sharing your creativity. And your creativity is not only the creativity in thinking, in writing, but also in painting your cartoons, which I really enjoy on Instagram. So if someone is curious about seeing Beverly's cartoons, go and connect with her on Instagram. It's really exciting how you kind of challenge yourself to try out new things and with that inspire other people. So a big thank you for that as well.
No, thank you. That was really enjoyable.
Yes, it was. And we're looking forward to the conversation next week. So join us next week again and have a wonderful week. Goodbye.
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 Wow, what a great episode again. This was Simply Focus Podcast with Alfie Cherney and Dominic Godet.